We'll walk on running. Brilliant. Well, you know, we like to be topical, and you know, I do feel we are topical here in trade. I think it's something you hear a lot about, exchange rates. Something that I think we need to know about, actually, you know, about, you know, different rates and percentages and everything. So I'm very pleased to have Winnie Meredith, but it's only the second person ever to both host and give a talk on the same occasion. Peter Waddams, if you wanted to know, which you probably didn't, was the first. So congratulations in all my years, which is, you know, I've lost count, when Brian May was quite... Oh, you've done, okay, Mary, right, okay, three of you. On the same occasion, yeah, all right, fair enough.
Before your time.
Yeah, well, oh, gosh, making me feel good. Anyway, we'll talk today about invoicing and pricing to market, evidence from UK export import transactions.
Thank you very much. So thanks everyone for coming, and because this is an economics paper, obviously I'm an economist, but please feel free to jump in with questions as we go through. What I wanted to do, Peter first approached me, I wanted to show you some of the stuff we're doing with big data now and with administrative records. And so this paper sort of has sort of three sets of techniques. So I have initially just some summary statistics that are new and original and interesting coming out of administrative data from HMRC. Then we have some sort of straightforward econometric analysis that kind of identifies some new facts. And then finally, we do something a little bit more sophisticated that really takes advantage of the structure of the data. And just as my standard disclaimer, this uses confidential administrative data from HMRC. They have cleared the results to make sure that there's no personally identifiable information disclosed. But they don't endorse or otherwise support the results. They just have allowed us to do the research and said that we didn't violate any privacy concerns. So the question we're interested in here is we start from the idea that the extent to which import prices and export prices change when exchange rates move play a key role in how shocks are transmitted across countries. So for example, like in the last couple of weeks, the Korean won has been falling in value as coronavirus has been getting worse in Korea. Okay, so there's some fear that Korea is not going to be doing so well in the long run, and so its currency is falling in value. Now, the extent to which that impact in Korea is going to push on to other economies would happen through, economists would expect, through changes in the prices. And so the question then is, if the won fell by 10%, does this necessarily mean that prices of Korean goods sold in other countries are also going to fall by 10%? Or is it going to be something different? Now, a large literature in economics has found, mostly focused on the United States, that import prices at the border are what we call excessively stable. So the prices of goods being imported into a country don't move as much as we would expect given the movements of exchange rates internationally, okay? And so understanding why these import prices are so stable is very important in terms of policy design. So for example, if we think about Brexit, the sterling fell 20% immediately after the referendum vote. The question then becomes, does this mean that prices of things that Britain imports are necessarily going to rise by 20%, or is it going to be something less? How we respond in terms of economic policy depends on how much these prices move. So just to give you like a concrete example of where, you know, the big picture of what this analysis is going to be trying to talk about. So this picture shows the growth in blue, the annual export, the growth in export value annualized. So this is using monthly data, and so it's looking at exports in, say, January of 2014 relative to exports in January of 2013. So it's an annualized export growth number, and it's showing it over like about 10 years. And so what you see is, first of all, blue is export value, so that's the price of what's being sold by British exporters times the quantity. Yellow is supposed to be a constant volume measure, so a volume measure, so it's supposed to be just stripping out the prices and showing us how much the quantity moves. And so what you can see is, like, basically, if we look before 2008, you know, growth is between 5 and 10%. If you look at this kind of period between 2013, 2016, growth is around 5%. So in many economies around the world this period, you know, sort of a long-run export growth is around 5%. The big first thing that sticks out is we had this what's known as the great trade collapse around the world at the time of the financial crisis. So this is starting in the third quarter of 2008. Exports started to implode everywhere as the recession was hitting everywhere around the world. So there's a huge fall in trade, much bigger than the fall in GDP. And then it kind of, there was a bounce back and things stabilized. The thing that we were hearing, or what a claim being made by many before the referendum vote, was if Britain votes to leave the UK, the sterling will fall tremendously because international investors will think the UK is no longer a good place to invest your money, and so there's going to be a big run on the pound will fall. And then the counter to that was like, well, that might happen, but actually that would be a great thing for Britain. Because if the pound falls, the prices of things that are made in Britain should also fall, and we should expect this big import boom. When people think about what was the cost of British goods being sold around the world, you know, the big components we can imagine, there's the wages being paid to British workers, and then there's other inputs being produced in Britain, so, you know, a wheel well going into a car, and then there's also imported inputs, so an engine made in Germany going into a car. But what we saw in the aftermath of this big 20% fall in the value of the pound was not really an export boom, but just kind of like a little bit of an export blip. And notably, the blue line is above the yellow line. So what we saw was actually a big increase in export, or the export blip that we saw was not primarily an increase in the volume of goods coming out of Britain, but it was really just the price of goods leaving Britain were going up. And then it kind of petered out. And you know, by the end, things are kind of back to zero. So the export boom that was forecast didn't materialize. And so what this talk is about, if, to some extent, is trying to understand what was going on with prices and why didn't we get an export boom in response to this large fall in the value of the pound. It's still, you know, 10, 15% below the value it had in 2015. So it's never recovered. So this is a permanent change in the value. So the currency is permanently weaker. We would have thought eventually there would have been some pickup here. Okay. So in terms of understanding this sort of puzzle of why import prices are excessively stable, there's been recent focus on the role of the currency in which a transaction is invoiced, and whether that is some indicator that can tell us something about how much prices adjust when there's a movement in the exchange rate. And so this is a sort of research agenda that's been pioneered by Peter Gopinath, who's just appointed the new chief economist of the International Monetary Fund. And so she had a very influential paper in 2015 where she kind of pointed out two things. And she said, well, a lot of people have spoken for years about what we call the excessive stability of import prices in the United States. And by this, she would give an example. We calculate a measure called exchange rate pass-through, which is how much does a price of an imported good change in response to a change in the bilateral currency. And so what she says is, well, when we look at U.S. import prices, the price of a good being imported into the U.S., the exchange rate pass-through is about 40% after 2 years. So what that means is if the U.S. dollar grows in value by 10%, the price of goods coming into the U.S. only rise by 4%. If the dollar falls in value by 10%, the price of goods coming into the U.S. only fall by about 4%. So really only about half of the movement in the currency is coming through to U.S. import prices. But she said, well, that's actually the case for the U.S., but it's not what we observe in other countries around the world. So if you look at economies as diverse as Japan and Turkey, what you see is after 2 years, a movement in the value of the yen is almost fully priced in to the change in import prices coming into Japan. And if you look at the price of imports in Turkey, a movement in the value of the lira basically fully is materialized in a change in the import prices Turkey pays. And her explanation, she says, well, actually, it's related to the share of trade that's invoiced in U.S. dollars. So one of the things we know about trade we've done surveys, so there's sort of patchy information here. But the key thing is, most U.S. trade is invoiced in dollars. But somewhat surprisingly, 71% of Japanese imports are also invoiced in dollars, although only 13% of imports come from the U.S. So when Japan imports things from Korea, when they import things from China, when they import things from France, potentially, a lot of these, the transaction invoice specifies a price in dollars. Similarly, Turkey, 60% of goods coming into Turkey have their invoices written in dollars, even though Turkey is a member of the European Customs Union, and only 6% of its trade comes from the U.S. So her sort of motivation was, knowing what the invoicing currency is on these transactions is important, and she's pointed to this idea that the dollar creates some of this excess stability for the U.S., but actually it means that other countries are really exposed to other fluctuations in exchange rates. So what matters for Japan, so in some sense, because all of Japan's trade is invoiced in U.S. dollars, they're exposed to sort of excessively unstable prices. Like, their prices are moving more than you would expect. Now, what we want to do in this paper is we want to think, what the question is, what can we learn about import prices, about the movement of prices over time by looking at the invoicing currency. And so one of the things we know about British exports, data reported by HMRC doesn't just record the price of something being traded, but it also tells us in which currency the transaction is being conducted. And so the first sort of set of questions are kind of descriptive. We just want to know, well, Britain's one of the few countries in the world to actually record information on the invoicing currency used for transactions. So the U.S. government doesn't record this. Within the European Union, it's not recorded for trade with other European Union members. Increasingly, over the last 5 years, countries in Africa have started to report it, but it's sort of new territory. We don't know much about it. So the first thing is just, what do we know about firms that are trading goods, and how do they use currencies? Do they use one currency? Do they use more than one? Do they change? Do they use the same one for a long time? Do they change their currencies? So it's just a bunch of descriptive questions. Then the second question is, what can we say about how much prices move when transactions are invoiced in different currencies? So is there something systematic going on here if we condition on the invoicing currency to we see different movements in prices? And then the final thing is to think a little bit more deeply about what the firm is trying to achieve and what we can understand about the level of competition firms face in different markets. And so when we think about a price as an economist, a price consists of the cost it makes, you know, your marginal cost of producing the good, but also there should be a markup above that cost, okay? And so if you're the only producer of something and you're not facing much competition, your markup could be quite sizable. It's going to depend on how much consumers want your good relative to other goods. And so we could imagine that in response to currency fluctuations, your marginal cost is going to change if you're using imported inputs from other countries. Okay, so if I'm importing that engine from Germany, if the sterling falls, my import side, my cost can go up. But it can also be the case that if I have a very large markup that I'm setting on a good I'm selling into, say, Mexico, if the currency moves and I have a big markup, I could either absorb, I could try to keep the price stable for my customer in their local currency, and I could absorb the loss if their currency falls in value. Or if their currency rises in value, I could get a big increase in my markup. And so there's sort of a question of the extent to which firms can adjust their profit margins on individual sales is related to how much market power they have in a different country. So the greater my sort of monopoly pricing power in a location, the more I can do what we call price to market. And this is also a measure of how the degree of non-integration of different markets. So if we observe firms using more pricing power and adjusting their markups more in different foreign markets, that's telling us that the product market for what they're selling is not very integrated with other markets around the world internationally. So the example is just wheat prices, they're the same everywhere in the world. Oil prices, they transmit very quickly. But when we get into automobiles and silicon chips, there's a whole lot of variation. Silicon chips looking a whole lot more like wheat, and automobiles, firms having a lot of pricing power. Okay, so our question is going to be a little, so I'll just, we're going to be focusing specifically on what does invoicing currency tell us about firms' market power. Okay, so I'll start out with just four stylized descriptive facts about invoicing choices. Then I'll do this sort of more straightforward study of what happened around 2016 when the sterling fell in value. And then I'll show you some more sort of sophisticated methodologies we're using to try to understand to what extent do firms have market power and are they adjusting their markups in foreign markets rather than just fiddling with costs. So the data, it's from HMRC. It's the universe of export transactions. We're going to focus on 2010 to 2017. The basic structure of the data, HMRC records every single transaction leaving the country to non-EU destinations. So if it leaves the UK and it's by any type of firm, we know a lot about it. We know the date, we know the currency of invoicing, we know the product to an 8-digit product descriptor code. If the trade is going to the European Union, we know far less. So for transactions going to the European Union, HMRC collects data in a different way. The firms report data monthly, and they only have to report very detailed data if they export a total of more than 250,000 pounds to the European Union in a calendar year. The other thing is, all members of the European Union do not record the currency of invoicing for trade amongst themselves. So there's an open question, what currency are British firms using when they sell things in the European Union? Are they using sterling or are they using euro? So you could ask the individual firms and try to do a survey. What we sort of think that what we uncover here is it seems very much like their pricing strategy. It looks like British firms are pricing in euro. Okay. And just to give you a sense of like the size of the data set.
Can I just ask, Meredith, when you say they're pricing in euro, is that an individual firm decision or is it something imposed or suggested by government?
No. It's individual firm. They can. The firm has complete control over this. So nobody would dictate in this country which currency they could use. So what we mean when I say pricing in euro, they're writing an invoice in a contract of sale with another firm, and they could specify the terms of that sale. And they can say sterling, dollar, euro, whatever. In some countries, say in Africa, we have more restrictive regimes and there can be non-convertible currencies. So in those situations, it's often the case that the central bank rations currency. So if you're in Ethiopia and you want to buy something from Germany, the firm that wants to purchase something and pay euros to a German firm has to get the euros from the central bank. And the central bank, if the exchange rate is having difficulty, the central bank can restrict the amount of euro they make available to firms. So there can be times when, in some countries, it gets a little bit more complicated. But here, it's a sort of completely open market, so they can do whatever they like.
Excuse me, are there large OEMs that, I mean, I work with Jaguar Land Rover, case
yep.
in point. So are they second guessing which is the best currency to trade in around the world for different markets and making a forecast maybe one, even 2 years out, but then they stick in for maybe a 6-month or 12-month window and they stick with the currency that they've chosen and then they'll flip it if they're going to get a better rate of return in another currency at a future time. So they've got them, have they got strategies sort of trying to forecast what might happen with the currency markets?
So it depends on the firm. I think Jaguar and Land Rover must have currency strategists in place. What they're doing is sort of the big question. And so I'm sure that they're in this data set. But I can't know who they are. And so the way they kind of restrict our access. So I'll show you when we get to some of the summer statistics, I'll show you. I think this has got to be where they are. They're doing sophisticated stuff. One anecdote I'll tell you is we had somebody from Caterpillar come and speak to us right after, you know, like about 6 months after Brexit. And this was somebody who's working, Caterpillar has an in-house modeling department that is doing, you know, they were doing sort of AI type development stuff. Mm-hmm. So they have a big supercomputer. They have 200, they have production locations like 140 places around the world, mm-hmm. and they sell into 200. So it's a big operation. But one of the things they told us was they have a global model and the day after the referendum, they have a plant in the UK that makes small forklifts, like little forklifts like you would have inside a warehouse, and they have the same product, identically, is made in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And the British market, or the British firm, serves all of Europe, and the Japanese firm serves Asia and North America, generally, but they can switch on a dime. And what they said was, when the sterling fell 20% in one day, they looked at the whole global supply chain for both of those plants and all of Caterpillar models, and they said, we're not going to sell anything out of Japan, we're going to sell everything out of Britain until we're completely run out of stock. And so they changed all of their orders globally. They looked at the transport costs. It was going to be cheaper to sell where Japan had been serving, like South and North America. Those markets went completely to be sold by Britain. So they have more margins of room. It's not just which currency they're using, but they can also change the production location. So here we're going to be kind of limited in that we're just going to be looking at UK-based production entities, and we're going to be seeing how they change currency response to these things. And just to give you a sense, this is a snapshot of the data on exports to the EU. So sort of the years leading up to Brexit, there's about 20,000 entities in the UK that sell more than 250,000 pounds worth of merchandise to the EU. We have, in terms of product details, slightly more than 8,000 detailed products that HMRC reports information on. So when we look at and count how many firm by product entities are there, so this would be like Jaguar would be selling a bunch of different product lines, there's between 350,000 to 400,000, and there's a lot of churning in the data. So if these firm product exporters that are engaged in the European Union, any one of these years, any of these, you know, 400,000, about 100,000 are new in any given year, and there's a little bit less than 100,000 leaving. Okay, so there's a lot of these firms are playing around introducing new products, products not successful, so they don't sell it the next year, or it could be in some cases a product that they only sell every other year, they could sell off a product line to another firm.
Sorry, just on that slide, you mentioned that these are only firms exporting over 250,000. How much of the market does that kind of include?
99%.
Okay.
Yeah, so there's another roughly 120,000 that the HMRC knows exist through VAT records. So there's about another 100,000 who report that they are selling merchandise to the European Union, but they're below this 250,000 pound threshold, so they only have to report the total value, not the product breakdown. So these guys are the big guys who have to, because they're big, report the product breakdown, so we know if it's industrial chemicals or car parts.
So these are relatively similar, whereas I was wondering, for smaller companies, they're going to have a lot less power to enforce contracts in, if the University of Cambridge is negotiating contracts, they can specify which currency they want.
It could go
joint blocks.
Yeah, we don't know, so it could go either way. So one way you could think about who chooses a currency. So on the one hand, if I'm Jaguar, I might have a firm supplying me, and they say, we want to supply you, but we really need this to be paid to us in U.S. dollars because we're in America, and we're a smaller firm, and we can't bear the risk. Jaguar would say, well, that's fine. We've got, because I can sort of hedge the currency risk of my purchase of you in dollars against some sales I'm going to make to another of some other part in dollars. So these big firms that have a more sophisticated currency, they might be willing to write it in any contract you specify and bear the risk. And my guess is that's probably what's going on. So when I've talked to people from currency markets, it seems like the small ones, they just want to invoice everything in pounds if they're in the UK, because that's what they understand, that's what they know. As you get bigger, you get more sophisticated. Okay, so four facts, very briefly. UK's trade is dominated by firms that use more than one currency. So if we look at UK exports outside the European Union, 99% of the export value originates from firms that use two or more currencies. I'll show some more detailed stuff on this. The second thing, and this was something quite surprising for economists, actually UK exporters selling the same product in the same destination will invoice it, nearly 50% of the export value is invoiced in two or more currencies. So that is, I'm selling women's shirts of cotton into Canada, and I'm selling, some of them are being invoiced in sterling, and some are being invoiced in Canadian dollars. It's the same product going to the same destination. It could be two different clients, but when we look within a calendar year, we see multiple currencies being used by the same firm. The other one is, UK exporters switch their currency a little bit over time. I'll show you the transition matrix. And the final one is the aggregate pattern of which types of currencies are being used is quite stable. So we look 2010 to 2017, we don't see big movements. So we didn't see after the fall in the sterling a big movement out of sterling and into other currencies. Okay, so I should speed up a little bit, but in terms of the first fact, what we have in the top part panel of this table is I've got all exports leaving the UK, and I basically looked at them by firm. So I said within a firm and within a year, how many destinations around the world does that firm serve? And that's the growth going at. And then I think how many different currencies is that firm invoicing in? So just to explain, if you look at the number 35.2, that tells us of all the firm year observations we have in the data set, 35.2% of the transactions are coming from firms that sell only in one destination and they use only one currency. But when we weight those transactions up by their trade value, which is what we have in the bottom panel, you see this very high share of transactions represents a tiny, tiny fraction of trade value, only 0.4%. So actually, if you go across the columns, what we see is most UK firms are using between 2 and 5 currencies, and most of them are selling to between, you know, say 2 and 5 destinations. But you can see if we get down to this bottom panel, the vast majority of export value is coming from firms that sell export goods into 10 or more destinations, and they're using 2 to 10 currencies. So this is, you sum up the 38, the 26, and the 35. So 99% of export value coming out of the country originates from these firms that are selling in multiple destinations and using multiple currencies. So these are your Jaguars and your Land Rovers. So here Europe is completely left out. So we exclude the EU because we don't know the currency. But a destination is generally a country. But in some cases where a country is not really a country, because not everyone recognizes it, it's a destination. So for example, Hong Kong is reported statistically as a separate destination. Taiwan is not recognized by all countries in the world. It's a destination. But generally, it's a country. Other questions? So in terms of, we then take the data, and so we look within we look at these transactions, and we take all the transactions within a year, and we aggregate them up. And so we look at the data according to a firm, product, a destination or country, and a year. And so we call that an observation or transaction. So here we say, well, what share of transactions at the firm, product, destination, year level are all done in only one currency versus are done in two currencies? So what we have here is the vast majority of transactions, so 84%, are going to one destination by a firm selling one product and they're just using one currency. But a non-trivial share of transactions, so 14%, are a firm selling the same product, the same destination within a year, and they're using two currencies. And again, when we weight that up by trade value, we find that these firms that are using multiple currencies for the same product in the same destination actually account for a lot of trade. So this is our sort of second big statistic, which is 56% of export value is the firm is using two currencies on the same product. Now, why this is important is you can end up with like sort of big price gaps between the firm selling the same wheel well into Canada, and it's got two very different prices within a period of time. Okay. Three, a transition matrix of invoicing currency schemes. So economists describe invoicing currency according to like broad schemes. So one is called producer currency invoicing. This means the invoice for the transaction is in the currency of the producer. So in the case of British trade, it's always going to be sterling. If I invoice in the local currency of the destination, we call it local currency invoicing. So we take all transactions where the currency on the invoice corresponds to the currency of the importing country, and we call it local currency. So Korean won into Korea, Japanese yen into Japan. And then vehicle currency invoicing is where you're using a major currency for a transaction with a country that doesn't use that currency. So for example, this would be using US dollars between Britain and Canada. So I'm a British exporter, I specify the price going to Canada in US dollars. Or I'm selling to Cote d'Ivoire and I specify the price in European euros. Okay, and so here what we have is, the key thing is if you look at the diagonal elements, they're all pretty high. So most economists sort of, before we've done this analysis, think, well, this is really, they expect the diagonal elements to be one, but if I use yen today, the probability I use yen tomorrow should be pretty close to one, why would I change it? And so here we see this is just pure changes. I've highlighted in red and blue the big off-diagonal elements, but you can see if I'm using local currency in period one, the probability I jump to going back to sterling in the following period is 18%. So I use local currency, I invoice in Canadian dollars, but the next year if I repeat the same transaction, I'm switching up to producer currency. So this is just to say, what we have here is the currency you use is a choice variable for the firm. It's not a fixed deterministic thing. We see firms using multiple currencies within a destination. We also see them changing them over time. So there's a lot more variation going on. And this is just the last picture. And this just tells you, if we, here we've excluded trade with the US because the US is a very large partner for Britain, and it also happens to be the country that uses the dollar, which is the most sort of important non-sterling currency for the UK. So we just said, if we leave the US out, what does this picture look like in terms of the share of British trade in sterling, which is going to be the middle set of bars, in vehicle currency, which will be the use of, say, US dollars or euro to countries other than the US or Europe, and then finally in the local currency of the destination. The black bar is transaction share, the gray bar is value share, but the basic thing is about 60% of UK exports to non-US, non-EU destinations are in sterling. About 30% are in a vehicle currency, so like US dollars going to Mexico. And then about 5%, so very small, is in the local currency of the destination, so Kenyan shilling going to Kenya. Okay, but that, in aggregate, doesn't seem to change very much, although the firms are making these sort of active choices. Now, what we do is, for our first sort of analysis of whether invoicing currency matters, is we just say, well, let's look at the 3-year window around Brexit. We know that the sterling falls 20% in the middle of 2016. What do we see if we condition on the invoicing currency choice that the firm is using over time? What happens to the prices of different goods invoiced in vehicle currency versus local currency of destination versus sterling? Okay? And I'll show you graphs in a minute, but the main thing that we see is that if you were invoicing in sterling for the middle bullet point, if I was invoicing in sterling, initially there's no change in the price. So really, the price in sterling of exported goods is flat and it very slowly rises. So what does this mean? If I were a consumer in Canada and I had a contract with you in sterling, I just got a big price fall from what I buy from Britain because you didn't change your sterling price really at all. So that means that the Canadian dollar rose 20% against the sterling. I just got a 20% discount. Interestingly, though, for transactions that are invoiced in local currency, so if it was invoiced in Canadian dollars, and I'm in Canada, when the sterling fell 20%, the sterling price being charged by the UK exporter rose pretty quickly, almost 20%. So what happens is if I'm the Canadian consumer and we had a contract in sterling, basically the British firm said, okay, well, I'm just going to jack up my price and I'm going to take all of that exchange rate as a big increase in my operating profit per unit. So this was sort of a windfall gain for these British firms. And then in the middle, we see something similar happening with transactions invoiced in dollars. So if you were invoicing in dollars, this is a windfall gain for the British firm, which raises their price in sterling. Okay. So more formally, when we think about the price change, we think about it as having three components. The black, point part C, is the marginal cost or the production costs embodied in the price. Then we have what we call a global markup adjustment. So a firm might have some profit, you know, 5% over marginal cost markup. And then the third component is what we would call the destination-specific markup. So if I'm selling to a market that's very small, not very competitive, I could charge a very large markup on my product. If I'm selling to a big competitive market like the US, maybe I can't charge such a high markup because there's a lot of competition. So what we're going to do is this event study is going to capture the whole change in the price. It'll include the global change in the markup, the destination-specific component of the markup, as well as changes in marginal cost. But if we think that in the short run, your marginal cost isn't going to change very much because you're still going to have the same workers, you're going to be paying them in sterling, you won't be giving them a raise, maybe your costs of your inputs haven't changed very much in, say, the first, say, 3 months or something, then we might think that this event study is telling us more about how the firms change their markups rather than their marginal costs. So this is just a graph showing you this 20% depreciation in sterling. The other thing I'll tell you is the aggregate shares of the currencies being used between 2016 and 2017 really didn't change. So although the sterling fell in value, that wasn't one of the margins of adjustment the firms exploited. They basically, when we look at the aggregate statistics, we didn't see any big systematic change in the currencies being used. Now, the first indicator that something funny or something different is happening around the time of Brexit, we can just look at the distribution of price changes in 2016 to 2017 versus in the previous 5-year period. So what we have here is, in the first panel, we've just calculated using annual data the change in the price, the blue dotted line, is the change in the price of a good being exported out of Britain by the same firm, the same destination. We're looking at the price in 2017 versus the price in 2016. Okay, so it's a 12-month change. The red line is showing us the average price change of British goods over this whole longer period from 2010 to 2015. So it's combining changes between 2010 and 2011, 2011 and 2012. So what you see is that with the red line, the sterling over this previous period, it's rising against some currencies and it's falling against others. So what you would expect would be price increases for some currencies, falls for others, but on average it's going to have a meaningful zero. And when you look at what happens with transactions invoiced in sterling, the distribution for things invoiced in sterling is the same. It looks different when you look at transactions invoiced in dollars. So when we look at the change in prices of goods being exported out of the UK, invoiced in dollars between 2010 and 2015, that's the red line, falls to normal distribution with a mean of zero. If we look at the change in prices between 2016 and 2017, what we see is there's a distinct amount of price growth. So prices of things being exported out of the UK, invoiced in dollars, when we look at their sterling price change, it's shifted to the right. So there's definitely, these prices are higher. Okay, and that tells us that in economic terms, there's going to be low pass-through of the exchange rate movement into the import price. So if you're the consumer of this British good, the price isn't going to move for you. All the price movement action is taking place on the exporter side in Britain. And then the third graph here is if you were invoicing the local currency of the destination, you have a similar thing. There's a bit more price dispersion, but red is the distribution of prices from 2010 to 2015, or price changes. Blue is price changes in 2016 to 2017. The mean is above zero, okay? So what you're seeing is on average, there's more price increases in sterling terms of goods invoiced in local currency. So in terms of like the statistical, we can make this a little bit more formal than just looking at the distribution. So we can regress. Y is going to be the price of I represents a product, F a firm, D a foreign destination, and T a time period. So in this case, T is going to be weeks. And we're going to regress it on a set of dummy variables that are just going to represent 156 weeks. The first week of January 2015 to the last week in December of 2017. So we're just going to have a dummy for each week. And then we're going to have a time invariant component of the price at the firm, product, and destination level. So we're just going to strip out each firm and each product and each destination's average price. And what we're going to be left with is just the change in the price week by week, or the change in the average price week by week. So we'll do this for each currency scheme. So we'll look at prices of goods invoiced in sterling, goods invoiced in foreign currency, whether that be dollars or local currency. So the first thing here is red is just showing you the time fluctuation in the value of sterling. Okay, so we've actually put it here as a reciprocal. So where you see the red line is going up to about 15-20% above, oh, sorry, everything is normalized to zero. And this is the third week of June 2016. Okay, and so this is weeks from the third week of June. So this is the last week of December 2017. This is the first week of January 2015. So red is going to be the movement in the time series, just movement in the value of the sterling. Positive values show that this is the value of the foreign currency relative to sterling. So 20% in foreign currency, 20% higher. And then blue is the price of goods in invoiced in pound sterling. And they're normalized to be euro in the third week of June. So the first thing you see is, if you look at the year and a half before the Brexit depreciation at the time of the referendum, the price is just basically bobbling around zero. So it's not moving very much. Then what you see is after the first 4 weeks after the depreciation, it really doesn't change at all. So if I blow this up, this is zero. And then starting in week four, you have this very slow, very gradual increase in the price of goods invoiced in sterling. So what this tells us is, if you were buying good from the British provider, they didn't change the price, you got a big decline in the price you were facing, and we would have expected an export boom. It didn't really materialize, though. Why? Other theories. One is that there's just a lot of uncertainty about Britain, and a lot of people weren't interested in buying stuff. So there was concern that, you know, it wasn't really worthwhile to form a relationship if you weren't already buying something from this country because of all the uncertainty inherent in Brexit. But you do see the price gradually drifting up over time. That seems to line up with the fact that over time, the price of goods coming into Britain were also slowly rising. So to the extent that what you export also has to reflect the cost of your inputs coming in from France or Germany, it's going to drift up slowly over time.
Just, sorry, what are those three troughs then in the blue line on the right-hand side? Are they coincidental with the same factor, the background factor? There are three blue troughs
on the,
which stand, on the right-hand side. So are they time-related, or is there a common factor for those three troughs?
I think in some sense, yeah, it's a bit funny. So if you think about the time of year, week 26, this is probably some sort of end of year inventory clearance,
okay,
or something like this, because this is June.
So that's
so
going
to
be December.
Is going to be December. So there might be some.
So it might be fiscal year versus financial year for individual companies.
Something like that. So that would be one explanation for this one. And then this is also going to be the end of December. So that could be some kind of end of year accounting or bookkeeping. So we need to clear things out. If we look at dollars, though, the key thing here is if you see there's just a huge divergence between the currency and the prices. When we switch over, though, to look at the prices of things invoiced in U.S. dollars, you'll see the price in sterling is very closely tracking movement in the exchange rate. So what it looks like is, you know, shortly after impact, the British firms have raised their price in sterling terms. They're getting this huge increase in their markup per unit sales, and it's tracking all the way through. And similarly, we have less data, and you can see the light blue dotted lines are the confidence bands around the point estimates. So much more variability here. But when you look at local currency invoicing, you see something similar. Actually, right away, the local currency invoiced transaction, there's a big increase in the sterling price. So if you were buying something from me in Mexico, and I was invoicing to you in peso, I increased my profit margin. So I raised the sterling price, got a big profit margin. I didn't give you any reduction in the peso price. And actually, over time, the price in local currency feeds the size of the change in the exchange rate. So it's sort of slowly drifting up even greater. So that's, so like the sum up there is the first thing we've identified here is I've already told you that the same firm could be selling to two different customers in the country using two different currencies, and we see very different pricing strategies. So currency does seem to be tightly related to the amount of profit taking the firms are going to get out of their transactions to different destinations. So the next question we have, though, is what we showed you in terms of showing you price evolutions, is that price evolution embodied the change in the marginal cost, the change in the average markup being charged everywhere, and the change in the destination-specific markup. So the next thing we want to do is exploit the big data aspect of this data set and try to identify specifically this middle component, which is how much do you change your markup differentially for one particular destination because your market power is increased there relative to other destinations. Now the reason, so we call this the trade pattern sequential fixed effects approach. In general, economists are interested in this issue of pricing to market and how much I set different prices in different markets because it reflects how competitive the foreign destinations are. The extent that we've got big differences in prices across markets, it's showing that markets aren't integrated, and so sort of the firm is exploiting some market power. And so there's a lot of interest in inequality these days. There's been a lot of focus on big firms like Google, et cetera, getting higher and higher share of profits and wages not growing with the same rate as corporate profits. So this feeds into that discussion. Essentially, do firms have too much power in setting prices? So the basic idea here, to sum up the model, is we can imagine the price that a firm charges. And so I would be for a product, F is a firm, D is a foreign destination, T would be a time period. We're going to say it consists of two components. So I'll be a little bit simpler here. The first component is specific to the product, the firm, the destination, the time. So four different features can determine what drives the markup. The marginal cost, though, the firm is producing something like a car. It's a product being made by a firm. It's only being made in one destination. And so within any time period, the firm has the marginal cost that shouldn't differ whether I'm selling the same car in Canada or the United States. Okay? So we observe this price that consists of a markup and a marginal cost only if exchange rates are such that the firm decides to sell into this market in the first place. So we've got two things going on when we look at prices. First of all, the exchange rate has to be favorable enough for the firm to make an active decision to sell into that destination. So if I'm in the UK and the sterling falls and suddenly the profits I can make selling to the US aren't really worth my while, I might not sell to the US. But if the sterling falls a lot against the US dollar, but only falls a little against the Canadian dollar, I might still choose to sell into Canada. So when we think about how to exploit these destination-specific markups, we need to think about where the firm is selling, and we need to think about the selection decision of choosing which markets. Once we've thought through that, we're going to try to do something with understanding the price dispersion. Okay, so we want to get at this destination-specific markup component. Okay, so the first thing that we want to do is if we want to capture this markup, we need something to control for the product-level marginal cost within the firm that we think fluctuates with time. So if I'm making cars and I'm importing engines from Germany, if the pound is strong, the engine's cheap. If the pound is weak, the engine's expensive. So the marginal cost is going to be moving. I also have to think, if I import that engine from Germany and the pound is also moved against the US dollar and the Canadian dollar, I have to decide, do I want to sell in both markets or do I just want to sell in one? So we're going to do this three-step procedure to try to isolate the component of the price that's specific to the destination. Okay? So for example, we developed this methodology of using Chinese customs data. And so here's an actual Chinese firm. It's got a firm identifier. And this is a product, Wheeled Tractors. So this firm is selling, in the Chinese customs data, that 2007 they're selling to UK and Australia. Next year they add Canada. They keep Canada. Then the following year, 2010, they're only selling to the UK. 2011 they're back into Australia and Canada. 2012 they're back to just UK and Australia. So the question is, if we want to try to figure out how much of a markup over marginal cost they're engaged in, we need to control for the firm entering and exiting these different markets. So we can think about a little bit more of a stylized example. So we just take that example, and here's the two acres. We think about five time periods. If I don't have the country's names are A, B, and C, if I don't observe a price because no sale occurred, it's just a blank. But so what we want to do with this trade pattern sequential fixed effects is we want to estimate how much the price is going to change, but not the price, sort of residual from the price. So what we're going to do is we're going to compare the prices the firm charges in country A in periods 2 and period 4, and the prices the firm charges in country C in periods 2 and period 4. And we can use this sort of, because the trade pattern is the same in those two destinations, we think that we're controlling for a lot of the unobservables that could be behind this. Similarly, we can use the trade pattern when the firm is selling to A, B, and C. We can compare prices in period 3 with those in price in period 5. Okay, so this is another expansion of this. So the data we would assume to have here, so we've got this matrix of prices going to A, B, and C. The first index, the letter tells you the country. The second one tells you the time period. We could rewrite that in a residual form. So we just take each price, and so we now rewrite the price PA1 as P tilde A1 plus an average price in period 1. Okay? And then we can do this for all of the different periods. So what we want to do is we can say, well, actually, the average price in any period actually is a very good proxy for the marginal cost and the general markup in that period. But we have to recognize that, I should use the colored type here. So if you look at period 2, I can see I have P tilde A2 and I have P2 average. So the nice thing here is I can identify the destination specific component of the markup, this mu A2, and what's left over, the average price, combines the average markup and the average marginal cost. But those are conditioned on the firm having chosen this trade pattern AC in period 2. And the idea is that we could have some things that are specific to the trade pattern. So an example I sometimes give is, suppose I'm a firm and I'm selling sneakers. This might be more suitable for China than the UK, but I'm selling trainers. I might have a really expensive trainer, and I might have a really cheap trainer. So the expensive ones could be blue, the cheap ones could be red. So in my customs data, I've got a mixture of those of trainers going to all different countries. And when I sell the trainers into the U.S., I might sell more of the expensive ones, like always a 70% share for rich people and then a 30% share for poor people. If I add into, and so maybe I always have that share, but if I sell the same trainers to Brazil, the shares might be different. So I might have 70% of the cheap ones in Brazil and only 30% of the expensive ones in Brazil. So the thing is, the cost, though, of selling into these two different countries is going to reflect sort of the product mixes. And that's why I have this view plus marginal cost subscript AC2. So the AC2 is saying, well, if I'm selling in America and I'm selling in Brazil, I have to control for the total product mix into those markets. And so the costs might reflect different kinds of mixes of products within that period. So what I want to do, if I add another country, it could be in the next period when I add markets C and D, or market C. Market C is actually a very high-income place that's going to have a share more like the U.S. So I really want to strip out of my estimator, I want to pull out this sort of time-varying marginal cost. But this time-varying marginal cost is likely, and it's likely described by some features of the countries that I've chosen to sell to. So I don't think I've explained that very well.
Like buying power.
It's a little bit like buying power, but I think it's really about when I sell. So as an econometrician, I can't observe everything that the firm can observe. I can only observe sort of what the government statistics have reported. So all I see is that trainers were exported. But I know in deep in my mind that there could be different varieties of the trainers being sold. And if I'm selling the expensive variety, the costs will be higher. If I'm selling the cheap variety, the costs will be lower. But my choice of whether I'm selling more of the expensive variety or more of the cheap variety is going to depend on two things. One, I have to think about, are the buyers in that market rich? Because if they're rich, I'll sell more of the expensive variety. I also have to think about how their exchange rate is right today. So if their exchange rate is really strong, I'll be selling to a country and I'll be saying, well, is this country a country that likes the expensive ones or the cheap ones? So their currency, there's sort of two things. The Brazilians maybe like the cheap trainers. So when I'm selling to Brazil, I want to sell more of the cheap trainers. But if I want to take all of the countries I'm selling to and put them into one big basket and strip out the average price to control for this marginal cost component, I have to be very careful that I'm always comparing apples with apples and oranges with oranges. Because where I'm talking about having a 70% mix and a 30% mix, this is where I'm saying it's the, do we have apples in the basket today, or do we have oranges, or does the basket have 70% apples and 30% oranges? So what I want to do, and the way I'm going to do this, is I'm going to hold the trade pattern constant. So if I see the trade pattern AB, I'm going to say these are two apple countries, so I can compare their prices over time. If I see the trade pattern AC, I'll say this is an apple in an orange country. So I always want to compare the price of apple and oranges together as a bundle. Does that make sense? A little bit.
Yeah. Well, you have to see the ABC.
My ABC.
Yes. And they're all, you know, they have the same sort of profile of conviction pool. So you've adjusted for that.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So we do this in sort of a three-step procedure. So Okay, so the first thing I do is X is going to be my price. My price is going to be product, firm, destination, time specific. I'm going to calculate within a period the average of the price sold by a firm or product over all destinations. And I'm going to take my price, which is represented by X, and I'm going to subtract the average within that period. And this is going to create a residual of the price in that period relative to that period's average. But it's not just that period's average. It's going to be conditioned on this letter capital D. Capital D is sort of holding constant the trade pattern. So I'm going to flag this up, and essentially I'm adding another dimension to this high-dimensional data set. So there's four dimensions we have to follow. Now I've said if we take the average here, because there's a big pattern of missing observations, I now, if I take a deviation from the average, I have to add a fifth dimension, which is the trade pattern. I then take what we call the destination demeaned data, so these x tildes, and I'm now going to calculate the average within a country over time. And so I'm going to look at, I'm going to calculate the time deviation, so in any particular period for a particular country. So say the price of the good going to Japan when Britain is selling the good to Japan and the United States. So I'm going to take the average price that the Japanese are charging for this good, and let's say I'll calculate the average, the average price British producers are charging to Japanese customers, and I'm going to take the price in every period, and so I'm going to calculate a time residual. So first I calculate a deviation from the mean over all destinations, then I calculate a deviation over all time periods. So it's sort of twice differenced data, and then with this twice differenced data, I'm going to progress the price on the bilateral exchange rate. And so this twice deviated data of prices is going to give me this estimate beta 1. And beta 1 is going to be what we call the destination-specific markup elasticity to the exchange rate. So it's going to be telling me how much did my markup in Japan change in response to a change between the sterling and the yen over time. And so it's going to be specifically isolating the change in my markup in Japan relative to the change in the markup I charge in the United States or Mexico or any other countries I'm reaching in that period. Sorry, I realize I'm going, I should be wrapping it up here. We also do a much more standard exercise that's done in the economics literature. So we just look at the price and we regress the price on the exchange rate. And we hold, we control for trade patterns. Okay, so I'm going to jump ahead. So what we do here, so we're going to look at what we call this destination-specific markup. And the first thing I do is I just look and I say, well, if the British are selling something to any country outside the EU, except, or sorry, leave the EU and the US out for a minute, British exporters selling goods just outside the US or the EU, how much does the price in sterling change when there's a 1% increase in the value of foreign currency? So on average, regardless of which currency you use, I'll put them all in one basket, I find that British export prices rise by 0.3% when the foreign currency goes up by 1%. Okay, what this means is the pass-through into the foreign currency price is 0.67. So it means that if I'm on average in this 3-year period around Brexit, if the foreign currency rose by 10%, the price that foreigners paid only rose by 6%. Okay, so it's only 2/3 of the price movement goes into the foreign price. Of this, how much of the increase in the foreign price is specific to a particular foreign destination? So how much is it that the British firm is specifically changing its market in Canada versus Mexico? So what we find is that the change, what explains the sort of increase in the price on the Canadian importer side of, say, 6% in response to 10% increase in the value of the Canadian dollar, we can say that about 22%. Should start over. I was trying to speed up, and so I think I'm just botching what I'm saying. The main idea is when the Canadian dollar appreciates 10%, the price Canadians pay rises by 6.7%. What explains the sort of 3% that they didn't have to pay? Okay, so what's the explanation for why didn't, well, where did that extra, you know, 3% they didn't pay, what explains that? Well, some of it is the, it's about one-fifth of that is coming from the British exporters saying, I don't want to charge them more because I have a certain amount of market power in Canada and I don't want to exploit them too much. I'm going to cut my markup in order to keep the Canadian consumers happy, specifically to Canada. So this is the average over all currencies. When we break this down and look at the differences across currency, the big thing we see is, first of all, something that confirms what we had in the earlier studies. For the things invoiced in sterling, exchange rate pass-through is quite high, 76%. Basically, if I was invoicing in sterling, you get a big price cut. If I was invoicing a local currency or dollar, you get a much smaller price cut. And it's only for local currency that the reason you're getting this price cut is because I'm charging you a very different price from other countries that I'm invoicing to. So in the case of why is it that the Canadians didn't have to pay, or why did the Canadians, sorry, the 42% says if the Canadian dollar appreciated 10%, prices to Canada went up 6%. What explains the 4% that's missing? About half of it, 0.48, is due to the fact that in Canada, I said if I raise my markup anymore, or I can afford to make you pay more, the incomplete pass-through, the exchange rate, is that you as Canadians are kind of stuck with me. I, as the British firm, have a lot of power, and I know that you're not going to go away if I don't give you this price cut, so I can afford to exploit you a little bit. The big picture that we find here is, first of all, this basic pattern goes through if we extend the sample even to before Brexit. So if we look at a larger period, we go all the way back to 2010, we can look at local currency invoicing, and we've seen this earlier period that a lot of what's called incomplete pass-through is due to British firms setting different prices in these different markets. Now, thus far, the analysis left the EU and the US out because those are the two biggest markets for British exports, and they also tend to be very influential currencies. If we add in the US and the EU, we don't know the currency being used to sell to the EU, but we can still just look at the prices in sterling terms. What we find here is basically two-thirds of the incomplete pass-through of exchange rate movements into import prices are due to the fact that British exporters are setting one price for the US market because it's a powerful and large market, so they're exploiting their market power there. They're setting a different price for the EU market in response to local conditions in the EU, and they're setting in a set of other prices for other countries around the world. So essentially this is saying, if we want to understand, I started with this puzzle, why do we have an export blip and not an export boom? What we see is when we look at the broad picture of British trade, the basic story is British firms are manipulating their prices a lot in order to take profits when they can. So when the sterling falls, they take advantage of that, they price the conditions in the foreign market, and they basically try to extract the profits out rather than trying to sell higher volumes. So one of the concerns we might think about going forward is if you think about, can Britain, by having a weaker currency, expand the volume of exports? Could this lead to more output coming out of firms and more people being hired in lower skilled jobs? Probably not. The types of goods being sold by the UK are sort of sophisticated goods that they're pricing in a very sophisticated way their customers, and so they're manipulating this sort of profit per unit in order to make sure they keep the customer relationship alive. So it's sort of the, I've gone so far over, been a very generous audience with your time. But the key finding here is that we see what we call this firm's pricing to market, and they do it through their choice of invoicing currencies.
If I may, I used to work at Jaguar Cars in the 90s, and they've always sold cheaper in the US than the UK. They offer a 4-year warranty in the UK versus 3 years here, and they also amortise massive warranty allowances for the US market as well. But the key question I've got is, you spoke about using the arithmetic mean in the modelling.
Yeah.
Did you consider other estimators of average? And the reason why I ask the question is that, I mean, I was aware until about 3 years ago of the 7 basic measures of average. And then I read a book on psychological statistics and discovered about another dozen. And that surprised me that not the psychologists use. And I was working with EMC, luckily, the US IT company. And I know, I can't say too much, but I know what they were selling, and we were not making any profit. And this particular widget, I'll just call it a widget, the price variations across the world went from like 1 cent to $99. And there was a recommended retail price of $64. But it was a strange situation, and it was right across all the international markets. And strangely, Japan was not part of Asia. Japan was a separate entity. And the reason I ask about these, that up is because the arithmetic mean is, it can be so biased by rogue values. And could it be that there is a better method, like a trend mean or a Winsorize mean, or another measure of average, which might give you more information from your models? That's my key question.
So, okay, so for this project, I have to go back and check. So, it's often the case with trade data that we do Winsorize really early on to take, not always, and people usually have it in the footnotes somewhere, but one of the things with trade values, if we see an increase in a price within like a certain, say, a time window to a destination of more than, say, 200%, so it's more than doubling, you either think that somebody has a reporting error, right, or something else is going on. And so we will often cut out sort of crazy outliers as sort of a first step, and then we're working within a sort of smaller sample. I didn't have it because we didn't get it released, but some of the results we did go back for some of our transition matrices, and we restricted the sample to only looking at the top 75. We looked at like large value sales.
Yeah, so you cleaned a lot of the data.
We cleaned, so we've done that before. I think this particular, so I guess we also, you know, when I showed you the distributions of prices, they're pretty big. And so, but I think we've got them cut off at the ends, and that might be because we went through and we do some data cleaning, especially when we're using administrative data. Sometimes when we're doing, you know, we also found in the course of this project there were errors in how the data had been given to us. And we were able to find it because we're just like, wait, there should be some, you know, just running a whole bunch of statistics. Things should look like other published papers, and here something's not going, and we can identify particular years where things have gone crazy. And we got them to redo it in that way.
One of the first principles you mentioned is, of course, that much of the trade is based on the American dollar as a currency value. Is that right?
So in the case of the UK, about 30% of exports will be invoiced in dollar or euro, but most of that would be US dollar.
But you also mentioned that countries like Japan, for example, use the American dollar. again as a trade index, if you like, a pricing index, am I right?
Well, so, I mean, the price they pay literally is the if the invoice is written in dollars, the Japanese purchaser will literally transfer dollars to the British firm. So, depends a little bit what you mean by an index. I mean, I think one of the things that we see in this data is if a British firm is invoicing in dollars and they're selling to multiple destinations, it looks like, counter to your example, they're setting the same price in these three destinations. So in terms of the strategy, when we have a firm exporting a single product to multiple destinations, you've got two things going on. On the one hand, if they're invoicing in local currency, there seems to be huge dispersion across the destinations in their prices. And this is how they actually implemented this, by using the local currency. If they set their price in dollars, with the exception of trade to the U.S., if they set their price in dollars, it seems a little bit like they have $1 price for non-U.S. markets. So if they're selling to Canada, Mexico, Japan, they'll set $1 price. But they're going to have another dollar price that seems to be specific to the U.S., that's moving with changes in the U.S. market. And so it seems like they've got sort of one view of, like, what's the global demand for my product? How's that changing? That's where I'm going to move the dollar price for extra U.S. sales. Another one is the U.S. is so big, as things move in the U.S., there's a tax cut, whatever, I'm going to change my price for the U.S. market. Does that sort of answer your question? So it looks like the strategy they're using across the board is much more complex than sort of a lot of our basic economic models, which we have sort of three generations of models. Generation one was everybody assumed that the firm was pricing in the producer currency. Then generation two, we said, oh, well, we think they must all be setting the price in the foreign currency because you want to keep the price stable for the foreign consumer. So we had a lot of models doing that. But that also didn't quite line up with everything. Then we had this third generation has been what we call the dominant currency paradigm, where they're focusing in on the use of dollar as a vehicle currency. And so they're trying to explain the asymmetries between pricing going to the U.S. and pricing going to other markets. But actually, so what we've got here is a bunch of empirical facts saying, well, actually, no, none of these models is quite doing it right, because actually we've got a lot, much more margin of adjustment in, at an earlier stage, the firm is choosing, am I going to do one currency, two currencies, multiple currencies, and that currency choice seems to embody the idea of, more deeply, is the firm going to set one price for all of its destinations, or is it going to set lots of different prices? So if they're pricing in sterling, they're going to be setting the same price everywhere. They're not going to be doing this more sophisticated, I'll charge one price in Brazil and one price in Mexico. And so, and they can also be doing the super complicated thing where they may be charging a sterling price in Mexico and in Brazil, and then they're also in Brazil going to also offer a real price to some customers, and that one's going to be different from the what will end up being the real price if it was, you know, the invoice was in sterling. So it's getting sort of complicated with a lot more fluctuations or deviations.
Is the choice of the currency more for the customer rather than the exporter? And so part of obviously cases where there's, you know, something that's in very short supply.
So this is a completely open question, and that we would love to be able to say more about this. I think in terms of a contribution, the first thing is just the fact that we've shown that there's variation. So then the next question becomes, is this variation arising because the customer wants it or the exporter wants it? And at some level, you could imagine that the customer says, I want stability, right? And so I want my price specified in my local currency because that's the same as my wages, and maybe my customers, I'm buying your part to sell locally. But alternatively, if the customer is, say, General Motors, you know, and they've got transactions all over the world, they might not care about the stability of the currency. They might want to get sort of the biggest margin they can, in which case they might say, well, what currency do you want? Like, we'll negotiate the price after you pick the currency. So there's a, you know, one, you pick the currency, but two, you're also picking the price at the same time. So I could, if I was selling to two customers in Brazil, say to customer one, well, if you want it in real, that's fine. And I'll think to myself, well, I'm going to charge you 10 real. And the other guy would say, oh, well, we're happy to pay in sterling. I'll say, okay, well, then I can give you a price that's going to be the equivalent of 8 real because it's easier for me. You know, so they can set, so the two things are presumably being happening at the same time. My suspicion is that if they're pricing in local currency, it's because they're more, the exporter's sophisticated and the customer is less sophisticated and the customer can't bear the risk. And so the exporter's saying, I'm willing to bear the risk, but it could also be reflected in that customer's going to have to pay a higher price for that privilege. So I think the two things are happening together.
Which suggests that the margin, profit margin on the product varies by country.
Yes.
And by, obviously, currency.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's usual, is it? Is that usual? Listen, I mean, here's a Jaguar,
for more sophisticated multinational enterprises, there can be a lot of variation. So what we know in general, and so like the Jaguar example, another one, there was a court case in the U.S. in the last couple of years. I sometimes have a newspaper article about it I share with my undergraduates. China is the opposite. It has, for luxury cars like BMWs, Mercedes, typically a luxury car, like in this class, would be like, say, $80,000 US, but you can buy a kind of low, fancy Mercedes in the US for, say, $30,000 or $40,000. There's a huge markup of the same model in China. And this is because sort of demand elasticities, these luxury cars are real status symbols for rich people, and so they really are willing to pay a premium. So there's two things. One, the firm selling Mercedes in China is charging a huge markup over their cost. There's also sort of a tariff barrier. So the government's also charging a very high import tariff on Mercedes going in. But so what a bunch of entrepreneurs in the U.S. figured out was they could go into Mercedes dealerships in the U.S., put down $40,000, stick the car in a container ship, send it to China, pay the import tariffs. You know, they own the car outright, sell a used Mercedes in China that's never been driven, and profit, a nice, $20,000, $30,000. And Mercedes actually filed a bunch of court cases to ban the export of their cars out of the U.S. because they had to set that low price in the U.S. because the U.S. is a very competitive market. There's lots of luxury cars, and consumers aren't willing to pay so much for the brand name as much as they are for the features. In China, people are willing to pay for the brand name. So Mercedes, BMW, they're all restricting supply. And so generally, trade rules are you're not allowed to put export restrictions on unless you've got some kind of sophisticated military technology. So I couldn't figure out for the life of me, but they found some sort of loopholes where Mercedes and BMW were trying to argue, well, if you export this, there was sort of like some consumer protection rules in the U.S. Well, if you export these cars from the U.S. to China, they're not available to U.S. consumers, and we're trying to keep the price low for U.S. consumers. And I was like, well, no, if you wanted to do that, you could double production. It'd be fine. You know, they're very active. So they were trying to say, oh, well, if we sell the cars here, some poor American is deprived of a low-priced Mercedes if you end up selling them all in China. Then we'll
twice
the price or something. It was like, well, no, you have all the capacity in the world to double your production if you wanted to. The price of this car could be much lower. You just don't, you're restricting supply so you get the high profit margin. And you're doing it to a larger extent in China. So I think this research that we're seeing with these British goods, on a positive sign, the fact that British firms are setting different prices in different markets means that everywhere they've got a pretty hefty profit margin. And so the reason you can only set different prices if you've got a big profit margin, right? So in one country you could have a 20% markup, another one you could have a 30%, another market you could have a 15%. If you were at a 2% markup, you have to charge the same thing everywhere. So on the one hand, it's good. It says that we're selling sophisticated products and there's this room to exploit it. On the other hand, as a consumer, It says that there's a lot of market power that the firm is able to exploit, and that there are some sort of restrictions on entry in some of these areas. And you know, the market isn't as competitive as it could be.
Yeah. Harley Davidson in the States, they don't allow exports to, say, the UK. You can buy last year's model of a particular Harley Davidson at a much reduced price than what you could buy in the UK, but you cannot export it as a personal export.
You can't. I mean, that's a high-priced product.
Yeah, they won't let you do it. So you pay over the odds here in the UK for a Harley, much cheaper in the States, but you can't do a personal export. Yours to UK.
So again, this must be one of these funny things, because technically trade rules don't allow you to ban the export, but I think they get all these kinds of sort of ways around antitrust law and consumer protection law to try to...
Basically, every producer worldwide, whichever market they're selling, they want to get the highest margin they can. And
there's
also
a million components in all of that. I mean, it's not just a product.
Well, they're optimizing the two together.
Yeah.
They're getting they're maximizing the total profit by choosing the optimal quantity and the optimal price.
And the impact of tariffs, Trump and China and tariffs and so on. I mean, that must damage the market for each company, does it not?
Yeah, so the US-China trade war, basic estimate, so I'm trying to think back, there have been two big papers looking at it. Basically, for the products that were hit with tariffs, which was about half the products coming into the U.S., there was the first impact was like a 30% decline in the volume of trade, so stuff coming into the U.S. from China. In terms of the prices, the question is, well, what got killed? What was in that 30% that just doesn't happen anymore? So I think these are primarily products that already had very small profit margins. So they were super competitive markets. And so the minute you raise the price just a little bit, they can't afford to sell into the U.S. anymore. The firms that have survived and are continuing to sell in the face of the tariffs, they basically forced all of the price increase onto the U.S. customers, meaning that when the goods came into the U.S. and they cleared customs, the same firm is selling the same product. They didn't change the price. So in the face of the tariff, economists expected, basically, you know, if the tariff went up 25%, we were expecting the Chinese firm might cut their price 12%, you know, so that the consumer only has to pay a 12% tariff, you know, like a 12% half that increase in price. But actually the Chinese firms have basically kept their prices steady, and the full 25% increase in the tariff went into higher consumer prices in the U.S. So that's for the firms that survived. About 30% of the sales, though, they just dried up completely. So that's a loss. And there's been increasing studies. So who does this hurt? It hurts you if you work in a manufacturing firm that uses imported parts from China. You're more likely to get laid off, reduced hours. So it's been very negative for the U.S. in the short run. It's been more damaging to China. And so I think this is sort of what Trump was banking on. Is he thought that this would damage the Chinese economy
more than
the U.S. That's proven right so far. I think the U.S., sort of in terms of the whole U.S.-China trade relationship, it's not very different from the European-China trade relationship, which is China joined the WTO in 2001. It was a poor country. Its GDP per capita was about $1,000 per year, which was pretty much the same as India's. Over the next 20 years, China has become, middle income country. Per capita income is like $14,000, huge increase in human well-being in terms of material consumption, right? People live much more materially rich lives than they did 20 years ago. For the U.S., we really didn't gain much. So what did the U.S. get from the relationship with China? Like Europe, much cheaper inputs. So basically, so much of the stuff we buy in our lives is much cheaper now than it would have been had China not engaged in trade on such a scale. clothing, smartphones, you know, a lot of this is invisible to us, but if you think about, you know, the computer we've got here, probably paying £1,000 a computer, year in, year out, but what we're not taking into account is how much the speed has improved, all the attributes, right? So a lot of technology, you know, the price of all these technology goods has not risen very much at all. And so on the U.S. side, we got cheaper prices of goods ultimately, but what happened in terms of manufacturing workers is trade with China just completely decimated in many areas of the country manufacturing employment. So all these lower skilled workers, you know, just the jobs did go, you know, to China or to Mexico. And so for a long time, the U.S. was filing various complaints against China. And the big complaint, which Europe has as well, is the state is very heavily invested in building industry. And a lot of the stuff coming out of China is heavily supported by state subsidies. The reason the prices are so low is because the government's been very actively engaged in subsidizing. So we saw with solar panels, you know, if you think, you know, you look around town, every house in Cambridge has solar panels on them. Well, in 2000, solar panels weren't a viable technology and they were very expensive. But the price just crashed because the Chinese, while the Germans were developing a lot of the technology, the Chinese government was pouring tons and tons of money into building up this whole industry. They over-invested in the industry, pushed the price of solar panels down. And so what you saw was all the solar panel manufacturers in Germany disappeared. The few that were in the U.S. disappeared. And the market is just dominated by, sometimes these companies have German names, but all the production facilities are in China. Mm-hmm. Yep.
The main question about your comments, if it's so successful, you don't surprise me at all, why don't you feel it in your pockets? Why are these practices, these are really to change? Why is they and not supporting the structure as they have started to be?
Well, so I think that there's a couple of things. So one is it's not a democracy. So you essentially, why are you able to tax the people so heavily and put all of this money into like state investment? So one is that China's growing incredibly fast. So while per capita income has been rising, it would have at some level risen faster if people had had more control over maybe the income they were receiving from their work, right? But in some sense, when you have this autocratic structure, the Chinese essentially have been taking, you know, forced savings. So how have they kept this trade flow going? On the one hand, the government has been keeping the value of the renminbi relatively weak by buying a lot of U.S. Treasury bills. So essentially, you know, as a country begins to develop, you would think that consumers would begin to buy more and more stuff, right? So China's share of consumption in its total GDP is quite small. So they spend a lot of the money is going into investment. So in a sense, what does this mean? It means that if I work and I earn a paycheck, I'm not really getting all of my paycheck. Some of this paycheck is going to the state in taxes, some of it's going to the company. And so it's almost like there's a forced savings plan that's going into investment. So now why can't everybody do this? Well, in some sense, it's a little bit like a Ponzi scheme in the sense that why were the Chinese able to continue to grow so rapidly? They needed to have somebody to buy their stuff. Nobody in China was buying this stuff. Who was buying it? People in the US, Japan, and the European Union. So it's not a sustainable model. And for at least 5 years, they've been talking about shifting toward a model where they get Chinese consumers to buy more of what they're producing. But you can see, in some sense, they have this glut of too much steel, right? They have a lot of these old-fashioned industrial, like, development. So they basically said, okay, well, the next generation, we have to keep this going. We have to keep people employed in these jobs. So let's start this Belt and Road Initiative and build bridges all across Asia and Africa. It sounds very nice that they're going to build bridges and roads all across Africa and try to help African development. But it's also very self-serving because they're charging Africans for all of this infrastructure. And, you know, there's you know, the, in some sense, like if you talk to somebody from, you know, an African country 10 years ago, and you talk to them about their relationship with China, they were very positive, and they would say, well, one of the nice things about talking to, you know, representatives from China is they treat us with a level of respect. You know, they say, you're a developing country, you need the bridge. We're not going to make sure that you have freedom of the press before we give you this loan to build a bridge. We're not going to make sure that you have anti-corruption drives. We know what life is like in a developing country, and we're going to give you the money and you can build the bridge. US, Europe, they put all these conditions on loans to Africa. And 10 years ago, the Africans were like, well, you know, you don't really respect us, blah, blah, blah. Well, now, flash forward, China, you know, a lot of African countries are saying, well, we got the Chinese to build this bridge, but it gave us no jobs because they brought in all their own labor from China. And the terms weren't as good as we thought they were. And we didn't get, you know, like, you know, the US or Europe gives us a loan for development. There's all kinds of requirements of competitive bidding, transparency. And so, you know, for the, you know, honest business person in an African country, the whole process was just sort of much more fair. And so I think that they're, you know, they're still happy to have some of this infrastructure development, but I think that relationship is not souring. It's a little bit, they're not so idealized. You know, they're starting to go, well, wait a second, you know, it sounded too good to be true. The Chinese were giving us this money to build bridges. Now we can see maybe they weren't, you know, maybe it was too good to be true. The strings attached were kind of...
So is the GDP gone from, say, $1,000 to $14,000 over 20 years? I reminded David Miner that there's a theatre company in Glasgow called the 784 Theatre Company. Because 7% of the Scottish population have got 84% of the wealth. And I wonder what the Pareto principle is in China from 20 years ago to now. I would imagine it's still like, you know, less than 1% have got 95% of the wealth.
I think it's much, it's... So we don't know because they started to suppress the statistics.
Yeah.
So, I had a slide for one of my undergraduate lectures. I think around 2010, there was still more, if you looked at the Gini coefficient or Lorenz curve or something, there was still more equality in China, urban areas, than there was in the United States. But you could see it definitely changing. I mean, I think, you know, when you, and I've, people have been to China, but I mean, the first thing you see, the first thing that strikes you is the size of the Tiffany diamond store and the Cartier diamond store and the Apple. There's so many cities of 20 million people or 15 million people or 10 million people, but I was in Hangzhou, which is like an hour west of Shanghai, you know, and I go there, I have a co-author at the university there, and so I go a couple times, and the first time I saw the Apple store, I was like, I just come from Chicago, and I was like, oh my gosh, the Apple store selling iPhones and iPads, you know, the flagship one in Hangzhou is three times the size of the one in Chicago, and the Tiffany Diamond store is much bigger as well. And I was just, you know, down in London near Sloane Square, like last week to visit a friend, and was walking past, like, you know, all these little fancy shops that you can never go into because you can't afford to buy anything. And I was like, my gosh, you know, the Cartier shop, you know, I was like, gosh, the storefront sizes here are so much smaller than the ones in Nanjing, because I had been to Nanjing University, and they have a whole mall, like nothing you, you know, and I'm talking about, this is London, like there's got to be more people buying diamonds in London than how many cities in the world. But, you know, the retail of this luxury good stuff in China is everywhere. And I think to myself, who on earth is, you know, buying this? I guess on the one hand, it could be that the property price is really low and maybe it's cheap to have a big sign and maybe they sell cheap diamonds, like, or, you know, or, you know, I don't know, like, you know, like, you know, you can see, you know, there's shops in the Grand Arcade that sell diamond necklaces for Valentine's Day for $200. So maybe there's a, you know, like teeny tiny diamonds or something.
Oh, yeah.
So maybe they're selling it at Cartier, I don't know. But it certainly has an appearance of there being this sort of huge, super rich elite in China. And if you talk to Chinese people, like, you know, in their mid-40s, early 50s, you know, there's a sense of, like, when privatization hit,
you know, things went crazy and just, you know, there was a period in which people took up a huge amount of corruption. So I don't know, though, because I think some of where the current president, you know, came in as this anti-corruption reformer and everything, but he's also very repressive. So it's a very, before coronavirus, I think things were looking very negative for political rights and democracy and stuff.
And that's going to continue, isn't it, by definition, maybe?
Well, I don't know. I mean, like, people are saying, you know, Chernobyl brought down the Soviet Union, so maybe coronavirus is going to be the thing where, you know, the lying gets to be too much. Because, you know, if your income is rising and... Okay.
For sure, right. That's the point. You don't want to keep people in. So it was a ideological choice that you brought down.
Well, but I think some of the lying and the deceit kind of came out. So I think that...
I was surprised by your reply, because when I asked you about China and when it moved from 1,000 to 80,000 to 40,000 person, in some sense I would expect that you would imply that this model of state sponsoring and organizing infrastructure is a key for the people when you go from poor to 40,000. And this model will not work when the population is already not developed. So different models for different states. And when you say an honest businessman and market, it's market. It cannot have honest business on the poor, I mean really poor, because it's the red line, at least.
Yes.
It's not here. Here you mark off your business, you
start something.
I know a builder who was fixing my house, he made himself public, and I knew within 1 year he was building the radicals.
Yeah.
This is not what the, so I think it's just normal that this more appropriate for that sort of position.
And also a model, but I guess part of it is that the model could only work while there was an outside purchaser, right? So people talk about, like, Korea did a very heavy level of state-sponsored support for industry starting in the 50s and 60s, like Japan did to a lesser extent. But Korea, basically, this idea of export-led growth, it can work as long as there's a market that can feed this growth. But if you're of the size of China, you run out of where you can sell the stuff. And so it's
that's still some level of structure and infrastructure support at the time down for the economy. Is the Keynesian idea?
Well, so there's this idea of big push, like you need something to get started. Yeah, and I think we're still debating it in economics, right? Is it necessary or could you do it without? But thank you all for all your questions. I should let you.
Let's get a round two next year.
Yeah.
I'll just switch this off now before we
Oh, yeah.
And here we go. I hope so. Oh, gosh, what am I...